So I'd like to begin with a little reading. Just to sit back and listen for a moment. We often think of rest as something that will come when everything else is complete, like when we go on a holiday or when our work is done, you know, summer vacation. We imagine that we can only find rest by changing the conditions of our present life. But it is possible to discover rest right in the middle of chaos. It is experienced when we bring our full attention and heart without distraction to this moment, to this activity, right here. This place of rest and deep peace is always available. We only need to turn towards it. So there's a lot of violence, spiraling violence in our world, as we know, and chaos. And for many in our personal lives, there's losses and insecurities and so on. And it's possible to not wait and think, well, it's when I get over this hump, or when the world finally figures out how to, you know, stop the war in the Middle East, or whatever it is, then there can be a sense of peace. And the possibility and promise, really, of this practice is to not wait. And that doesn't mean the kind of rest or peace where we get passive or inactive. But it means we don't wait to come home into a quality of presence and wakefulness and heart in the midst of it all. One of the great Zen masters from the 7th century had one of these kind of most famous teachings that's all around now, and it kind of is summed up by saying that true freedom is being without anxiety about non-perfection. True freedom is being without anxiety about non-perfection. So that's the theme of tonight. The reason that for this moment it felt like something I really wanted to talk about is it just seems that we're continuously in a kind of reaction to life being not quite right. I mean, sometimes it's very, very wrong, but often it's just not quite right. Like we're waiting to get a little more comfortable, or to get the next meal, or to get some rest, or we're feeling just a little off balance. Sometimes it feels very bad. But there's always a sense that we should be doing something, or fixing something, that there's some wrongness going on, and usually it's perceived as inside me, so that we are often in some way feeling like it's not okay to rest or relax because we still aren't who we want to be or doing what we should be doing enough of. So what I'll do tonight when we talk, as we reflect on being without anxiety about non-perfection, is really talk about how we get anxious about our personal non-perfection. I could just as well be talking about the world. It's the same teachings, the same practices. So first, just a brief reflection, if you will, as I ask you to do, just to close your eyes for a moment. And just allow your mind to scan and just register what you might call your personal non-perfection. It might be your neurosis in different ways, the ways you get obsessive, or maybe selfishness, or maybe the non-perfection of being addictive. We're all so addictive. Or maybe it's the non-perfection of your body, or a way you think you're klutzy or not smart enough, or whatever it is. Just the way you move through the world that your senses is very not perfect. Maybe more too aggressive, too passive. This is a quick scan. And imagine, what would it be like to be without anxiety about this non-perfectness. Like really without anxiety about it. Can you even get a glimmer, a felt sense of what would it be like if for the rest of the evening or tomorrow you could move through and there was still a non-perfectness, but there just wasn't anxiety about it? As Elizabeth Kubler-Ross says, you know, I'm not okay, you're not okay, and it's okay. You know, that one. Okay, so we'll come back. We'll be revisiting this more and more. Open your eyes if you'd like. So, for myself, if I can even get a little glimmer that that's even a possibility, that the same conditioned neurotic person's here, but it's possible to not be anxious about that, that it's okay. There's this, like, I get this kind of exhilaration, like it's a taste of freedom. And we all intuit it in some way because some part of us knows that that imperfectness isn't the definition of who we are. It's just part of the human condition. But most of the time we're pretty anxious about it. We're pretty not comfortable with it. So for the last few weeks, I've been away. I've been in New England, and it was a mix of teaching and vacation. I taught a course for psychologists there on how to integrate mindfulness into psychotherapy. And this was a key theme in that training, which is that probably the most pervasive suffering of clients and students and all of us is this feeling of flawedness, this sense something's wrong with me. And that's the core thing, this selfness that thinks the self is not okay. And so a lot of the training was about how do we take those feelings of I'm not okay, I'm bad, I'm falling short, I'm not enough, and how do we begin to have a little more space and lightness and freedom around that. So that was a theme during that teaching, but it was also a theme in my vacation time. I was with my family for 10 days, and that is a setup for regression, right? I mean, we all know it. So it's really, it's the recipe. So I went into my oldest daughter where my idea of who I should be is, you know, helpful and understanding and sensitive and supportive of everyone else. And that went into direct kind of conflict with wanting things my own way and being judgmental and controlling and all the stuff I do in my family. And so getting face to face with feeling like a selfish person or an inadequate person or a picky person or I was impatient, you know, getting face to face with that, it was like constantly either in the trance of I'm bad or else in this process of how do I find some space, some freedom? How do I be without anxiety and acknowledge this is how it is? So let's see what it means. What does it mean to be without anxiety about non-perfection? And the first question is, what do we mean by perfection, right? So for me, I'm going to use my own example since I've just come out of several weeks of being in it. Might as well share it with you. For me, perfection is when I'm feeling loving and I'm feeling awake and generous and, you know, not self-centered, you know. And also when I'm feeling good and energized and perfection's also when the people around me that I love are all happy and energized and feeling good and, you know, that kind of thing. And then on a more subtle level, perfection is when I, you know, would be finding the perfect, I was always searching for these little angel wings, these little porcelain shells, these tiny miniature shells, to find a whole one, you know, a pair that are whole, or to ride the perfect wave. To be at the beach just when it's low tide. I'm a fanatic boogie boarder, as some of you know, and to be at the beach at low tide just when the waves are perfect, you know, that's perfection. So what's non-perfection then? Okay, and now we're getting to the first noble truth. Okay, the Buddha's first noble truth. And the first noble truth is that no matter how we want it, it's often not that way. that there's a kind of unease that we experience that's intrinsic to existence. There's a stress that just being in a body means we're going to get hungry and at times not have food, or get uncomfortable and not be able to find a way to get more comfortable. We're going to have our bodies get sick, get old, and die and not want it to be that way. There's a constant kind of stress in just existing. And for me, the first Noble Truth while I was on vacation was that, you know, I found myself getting caught in my own controlling, selfish insensitivities. And the first Noble Truth was that the people around me weren't always happy. My mom was having chronic pain in her back, and it was very hard to just let that be there. And I didn't find that perfect angel wing, you know. So this is the first Noble Truth, that in this natural world, there's going to be tension. It's going to be not perfect according to the way we want it. Okay. Now, there's a saying, pain is inevitable, but suffering, which is the second Noble Truth, says here's what happens. Here's how it turns to suffering. And in the second Noble Truth, the pain and unease becomes not okay, so we resist it and we grasp. We start suffering when we want it different. Okay? So there can be pain, but we're okay with it. That's not suffering. But as soon as it's not okay that I'm being selfish, and it's not okay that my mom's back is hurting, that's suffering. Does that make sense? Pain is inevitable. The suffering is when we add on the emotion of something's wrong, it's not okay. When there's grasping, when there's resistance. The Buddha talked about it as two arrows, and I think it's a really useful metaphor, where that the first arrow is the inevitable pains, that these bodies get sick, we get tired, things go wrong on that level. The second arrow is thinking something's really wrong, judging it. It's not okay. Having to change it, having to resist it. The third Noble Truth is that freedom is possible. That even in the midst of these bodies getting older and getting sick, even in the midst of the fatigue or tiredness or anger or sadness, we can find a quality of genuine freedom. And the fourth Noble Truth is, here's how. And the essence of the Buddha's teachings on here's how is to meet the non-perfect, to meet the conditioning of selfishness or hurt or sadness or fear with unconditional presence. Rather than making it wrong, we meet it with total presence. And that is the heart of the teachings. Some of you might remember this statue here, this Buddha. I've told this story. I got it when I was up at Cape Cod, which is just where I was. Luisa Montero Diaz was visiting me, and we found it in a little shop in Provincetown. And to us, we're just meditating on it, and it reflected this kind of the composure and the peace and the awakened heart of the Buddha. We just loved it. And so we thought we'd buy it for this community, and we bought it and brought it here and put it here. And I noticed at the end of the first night, after I introduced people to the statue, that a handful of people were standing in front of it but kind of leaning to the left as they were looking at it. So I went over to it, and I realized I was leaning too, and it was with horror that I realized that our beautiful Buddha had a mold that was leaning to the left. Now, if it has to lean one direction, why not? But so my first response was, oh my God, we got a bad Buddha, you know? And you know, here we were, we had felt so good about it. But then it was in some time that I realized how absolutely what a gift it was that this that the molding or the cast was not symmetric, because we're not symmetric, and things aren't the way we think they should be. And the innate goodness of our being and the awareness and the love that is who we are can shine through just the way a tree, when it's leaning to get sun, might not be as straight as another tree in the woods, or the moon's not always full. It's just okay. You know, it's not okay, but we can be okay about not okay when it hurts. Suzuki Roshi, some of you might know, a wonderful Zen teacher. There's a little story about him. During a break in one of the early shashins, a student returning to his seat early straightened a picture on the wall before he sat down on his cushion. Only he and Suzuki Roshi were in the Zendo at the time. After a moment, Suzuki Roshi got up to leave the room. He walked down the aisle, stopped at the picture, returned it to its crooked position, and continued out the door. That's the whole story. Without anxiety about non-perfection. So there's really a sense of just open. I mean, it's as with the serenity prayer. Of course, we change the things we can change, but there's a real sense that there's the inevitable off-balanceness and the inevitable sadness or fatigue or whatever it is, and that our way of relating reflexively often is something's wrong, and that's the second arrow. That's the suffering. And there is a very radical and liberating way of relating, which is, oh, okay, it's leaning, or it's hurting, or it's tight, or I'm sad, whatever it is, just to meet the experience directly. So one of the most important inquiries then is, well, what stops us? What stops us from, in some way, this we're talking about radical acceptance, deep allowing things to be as they are, what stops us? And so you might, again, go back to this reflection that we started with of just scanning what's not perfect about you. So this is an invitation again, just check in. And just bring to mind the not perfect. It might be you bring to mind a most recent time that you lashed out at somebody or judged somebody or acted hurtfully. It might be something that happened today where you just was just an example of a part of yourself you don't like. You're letting yourself just acknowledge the not perfect. It could be the way the not perfect is in relating with other people, at work, addictive behaviors. And the inquiry is, what gets in the way of just bringing unconditional presence? What stops you from accepting? What stops you from just relaxing and letting it be as it is? Okay, so this is part of this conditioned humanity. You can continue reflecting. Just consider together, and I'll share with you what happens to me. You know, why is it hard to just say, okay, without anxiety about this not perfection? So there I am on family vacation and locking into a sense of being a selfish or inconsiderate person, pushing my agenda, having everybody do what I want to do because I need to get to the beach in time for the low tide, that kind of thing. Or even more, as I mentioned, my mom's back was hurting. And so how to say, okay, so this is just what's happening and not make it wrong. And so when I reflect on it, there's a deep something's wrong feeling and there's a deep sense of I should do something about it. whether it's doing something about being a selfish person or doing something about my mother's pain. You know, that it feels like not only is there a belief this is wrong, there's an anxiety in the body. So to say, to be without anxiety about non-perfections, like saying be different, because the anxiety's there. So it's important to acknowledge that anxiety about non-perfection is part of our biological and psychological rigging. Okay? In other words, part of surviving is to be anxious about and think something's wrong. If we have a child that's running into the street, and that's a not perfect kind of situation, our anxiety tells us to run and grab them, right? So it's not about eliminating that feeling and that energy towards doing something. But as we know, our anxiety about not perfection proliferates and starts to define our whole sense of who we are. That's where the suffering is. It starts telling us bad person, bad person. So this isn't about getting rid of anxiety and just saying, oh, whatever happens, happens. You know, it's Carlin puts it this way. He says, they show you how detergents take out blood stains. I think if you've got a t-shirt with blood stains all over it, maybe your laundry isn't your biggest problem. So this is not about get rid of anxiety and any motivation to take care of what needs to be taken care of. But this is about waking up from the trance where our whole sense of our being is something's wrong with me. We move through life afraid of making mistakes. Where our behaviors with other people are absolutely confined and imprisoned by some sense of I'm flawed and they're going to know it. And I'm going to get hurt. So I just want to make the differentiation between what's a healthy emotional response. Anxiety, letting us know we got to do something about, that's really more like fear, letting us know we need to act, and a chronic anxiety that of personal badness. Okay, is that clear? Because the chronic anxiety about badness is sometimes described as we are at war with ourselves or others. And this kind of, it becomes a kind of contempt towards ourselves and others when it locks into a trance, a basic blame. That something is fundamentally bad about me or bad about you. That's the trance that we're waking up out of. And I think it's interesting, I was reading some about divorce, and the major predictor is contempt, is this attitude of that the anxiety about non-perfection locks into a kind of contempt. That's the major one. And it's the major prediction of divorce, and it's also the major indicator of our own suffering, when there's a kind of contempt or disgust or aversion towards ourselves. So this is a really question of how do we wake up out of it. And it's very much in our culture, the sense of something's wrong. It's very much in our political system that our political parties cannot cooperate in any way because there's such a deep kind of contempt. And sometimes it turns to ridicule. Some of you might remember one of my favorite stories. A young woman was pulled over in Austin, Texas for speeding. As a Texas state trooper walked to her car window, flipping open his ticket book, she said, "I bet you're going to sell me a ticket to the Texas State Police ball." He replied, "Texas state troopers don't have balls." There was a moment of silence while she smiled and he realized what he had just said. He then closed his book, got back into his patrol car and left. She was laughing too hard to start her car. So it's in our culture. It's the kind of ground of a lot of humor, and it's also a ground of a tremendous amount of conflict and war. Contempt towards ourselves, contempt towards each other, and it comes out of this basic anxiety about not perfection. We know for most of us that it's turned on ourselves in a way that sabotages really living and loving fully. And when I work with students and clients, and they begin to get how many moments of their life have been contracted or squeezed by this trance of something's wrong with me, it's a breakthrough. In other words, if you can really register how many moments that when you were with other people, you weren't able to really be affectionate or love without holding back or be playful or be spontaneous because there was an internal program going of, I'm not perfect, something's basically wrong, it's not okay right now. It makes it so it's not safe enough for us to really be fully who we are. It's a breakthrough to even begin to recognize the grip of that trance, of that anxiety about not perfection. I consider it a kind of necessary first step to waking up from the trance, is to get just how bound we are. How many moments today, this is a question for you, did some undercurrent of not enough, not good enough, not okay, not quite who I should be, how many moments a day was that undercurrent there to kind of sour or dull or kind of drop the energy? So the inquiry then is, once we begin noticing what I'm calling anxiety about not perfection, and we might also just call in a very basic way self-aversion, something's wrong with me, how do we begin to wake up from it? And the most fundamental teachings in our practice of unconditional presence are taught with these two wings, and we need both of them. And one of the wings is to, in the moment, recognize what's happening. It's that question, what is happening inside me right now? So that we have to pause. And I call it the sacred art of pausing, because if we just tumble into the next thing, we're operating out of that trance of something's wrong with me. We get busy, we do more, we try to pretend, we try to prove ourselves. We're just using our strategies to compensate for unworthiness. So we pause. And I find for myself that unless I pause a lot, unless I slow down a lot, I keep playing out the persona that is running out of that anxiety. Does that make sense? So, in spiritual life, if we want to wake up out of this prison of something's wrong with me and something's wrong with you, if we want to see behind the veil and remember innate goodness, we need to start by pausing and that basic inquiry, what is happening right now? This is the wing of seeing what's true. It's very useful to name or note things. You can use a mental whisper just to notice and name, you know, anxious thoughts, self-judging, fear. We can do it with each other, this naming. This first wing is very powerful of noticing what's happening. In fact, the shamans say if you can name a fear, it no longer has control over you. I'll read you, this is from Robert Johnson. He says, the night before their marriage, they held a ritual where they made their shadow vows. The groom said, I will give you an identity and make the world see you as an extension of myself. The bride said, I will be compliant and sweet, but underneath I will have the real control. If anything goes wrong, I will take your money and your house. They then drank champagne and laughed heartily at their foibles, knowing that in the course of their marriage, these shadow figures would inevitably come out. They were ahead of the game because they had recognized the shadow and unmasked it. Okay, the first wing, naming what's happening in our relationships and in our relationship with our inner life. Oh, fear. Oh, shame. Ooh, jealousy. Anger. Krishnamurti describes this process this way. He says, as long as you're trying to be something other than what you actually are in the moment, your mind wears itself out. But if you say, this is what I am, It is a fact that I'm going to investigate and understand. Then you can go beyond. So rather than sensing not perfection and trying to cover it up, trying to change it, trying to manipulate it, try to show other people we're something else, it's this courage to say, okay, so this is what's happening right now. It's amazing if we can stop trying to make it different for the moment and just have that courage to say, oh, it's like this. In that moment, we discover the capacity to be more fully who we are. It's like Carl Rogers said, it wasn't until I accepted myself just as I was that I was free to change. Okay? This is the first wing. See it like it is. The fear of the first wing, oh, if I acknowledge that I am jealous, or if I acknowledge that I'm needy, or if I acknowledge that I'm selfish, that's the nail in the coffin. That's who I am. We're afraid it just establishes as fact and that it'll in fact get worse. Oh, if I just acknowledge that I'm angry, then I'm just going to become, you know, rape, pillage, plunder, crazed maniac, you know. That's the fear of just naming with acceptance. Okay, it's like this. But the truth is exactly the opposite. If we have the courage to see what's true, like the shamans say, if we can just name it, we can name the not perfection, then we begin to reconnect with the awareness, the wakefulness, the love that really is more fully who we are. So this is, I'm right now talking about what I consider the primary mechanism of mindfulness. That in the moment of noticing what's happening, our identity, our sense of being enlarges and we're no longer hitched. Our identity is no longer hitched to the shadow. We become the space that includes it. We become the ocean that includes the waves. Okay? That's the first wing. The second wing that we talk about, oh, let me just say a couple more things about this seeing what's true. It really helps to ask, what am I believing in that first wing? Part of noticing what's happening, what am I believing? Oh, I'm believing that this means I'm a bad person. You know, this was me on family vacation, that I watched myself be controlling and insensitive and irritable and so on. And I went into, and the undercurrent was some deep belief, oh gosh, all these years of meditation practice and this is what I have to show for it? I'm acting like this? Bad personhood, you know? So what am I believing? It helped me to even notice that was the belief, because as soon as I noticed the belief, it no longer was ruling me. Another question you can ask yourself in this first wing of seeing what's true is, what's the unmet need going on? You know, for me, there's when I'm on vacation, because I don't have a lot of vacation, there's this sense of wanting to be fully alive. So I get very attached to doing the things that really rev me. It's almost like this desperate thing of wanting to feel fully alive. But that's a need, you know. So if we can begin to name the need, again, there becomes more perspective and space. The first wing, seeing what's true. The second wing, being with it fully. It's the quality. If the first question is what's happening, the second question is, can I be with this? Can I give the space, the warmth, the presence, and be with it? Okay? Those are the two questions. For me, and just to kind of finish up on what happened to me with, getting stuck, was that the issue that I felt most caught in anxiety about not perfection had to do with my mom hurting. And so when I started noticing, okay, so there's a lot going on around this, I felt the anxiety, and the anxiety was impotence. The belief was, I should be able to do something and I can't. And the need was actually a need for connectedness with her, that if she got sick, I'd lose connection if she was less alive. It's like loss of person, the need for keeping her and being active and with her. So the second wing, to be with that, meant to open to that anxiety, to open to my speediness. I was trying to control her and make her, you know, walk, you know, treat herself right and not go for walks with this dog that was dragging her around. And I was trying to get her, control her so she would get better. To notice that, to name that, and even more deeply, to be able to, instead of going into my behaviors, recognize the fear and recognize my sadness about her hurting, because that's what I was running away from. And then underneath that was the love. If we take the time with these two wings of presence, and instead of all of our trance of something's wrong with me, stop running and open to what's here, what we find is the awareness and love that is our nature. But there are layers that, when unexamined, keep us in that trance. The key to being able to open in this way and wake up out of the trance of unworthiness is that we have the courage to be in our bodies, to feel and breathe with what's right here in our bodies. There's no way to really befriend what's going on in a way that liberates if we can't feel it in our bodies, sometimes our throat, our chest, our belly. Now, there are times that we're traumatized and it's too much. And I just want to say that sometimes the teachings are open to it fully and be with it fully, and we can't. And so there's a wisdom and a compassion when there's a lot there, a lot of fear, a lot of hurt, to be gradual, or to get help, to have someone that we trust keep us company, to create a safety, to be with our experience in a deep way. But ultimately, we want to, instead of believing in the trance that something's wrong and running away from our vulnerability, the pathways to come home into these bodies and into the moment. And in that coming home, in that opening and wakeful presence, we rediscover the openness and wakefulness that is our nature. I want to read you a short story that I thought exemplified this. A woman who's a meditation teacher described her own experience of awakening like this. She said, "A large abdominal tumor was removed, and with it all that I had clung to as certainties in my life. I quit work and I stopped the spiritual teaching. I turned to anything I thought might help me change what had led to that cancer, from acupuncture to depth therapy. I became humble before the body. That was 15 years ago, and I can now say that it was the biggest turning point and awakening of all. Before, I had used my body to practice. Now, I had to inhabit it, respect it, love it with all the feminine force and nurturing and understanding I had withdrawn into my spiritual life. Keeping my heart in my body became my practice, and it has become glorious. Even the first awakenings into perfection and grace did not come close to showing me the joy of living in the body, in the senses, in each moment. I love my life in a new way. This has become the place of freedom." I share this because we so often think of spiritual awakening as some transcendent thing where we go beyond the body into crystal rainbows of light and there's some otherworldliness to it. Whereas really our path is to come home and find the peace and the presence and the love right in the midst of what's happening in this living, dying body. And in this, the chaos, the beauty, the mystery, the sadness of our world. Often I describe it as waves in an ocean, that we open and inhabit the waves, and as we inhabit the waves, we discover our oceanness, that vast heart that has room for it all. So the path is really to stop judging and struggling against the fact that things are slipping through our fingers, that there's no real ground to stand on, that our pleasantness goes and unpleasantness comes and then unpleasantness goes. It's not to fight it. It's not to control it. It's to inhabit these lives wakefully. And as soon as we open and relax this tight fist that's trying to control so much, infinite space is here. I read that about resting. When we really start resting in this moment, opening to just this, there's a tremendous space, a tremendous heart. So let's just, maybe as the final piece of this tonight, just to talk about, and I'm not about to have you meditate, although it's fine if you want to sit up straighter. So many of you are primed. It's so funny. That's great. I want to name what I think are really the gifts of being waking up from this trance of something's wrong with me. You know, Sri Nisargadatta said, and I thought this was really wonderful, he said that when we awaken, there's really no words to describe it, except perhaps to say, nothing is wrong with me any longer. So there's this gift that comes in waking up, and waking up from this kind of chronic belief and feeling of flawedness or wrongness, of making ourselves wrong. And one of the gifts is when our filter is no longer something's wrong, we get to see life as it is. In the moments that we're not judging, manipulating, controlling, we can see clearly what is happening in the moment. As long as we're controlling, and this is the law in physics and it's the law in our inner physics, as long as we're in any way manipulating our experience and judging it as wrong, we can't see it. We can't see what's true. So what we miss is that it's always changing. What we miss is that any effort to control or resist brings suffering. And most basically what we miss when we're trying to manipulate is this realization of the essential openness and tenderness and wakefulness of our nature. In other words, we don't see who we are because we're identified with the self that's busy trying to control. To not resist is to dissolve that selfness. We're afraid of putting down our resistance because we are very familiar with the sense of self. So the most radical movement we can do in spiritual life is to stop resisting, stop making things wrong. If you ask yourself, who am I if I'm no longer judging this life here and that life there? Who are we? It's like the whole sense of our familiar selfness begins to dissolve. We can't find someone here when we let go of that sense of something's wrong. One of the most beautiful things I find happening when, we're working and when I'm like with a student at a retreat and there's this process of sensing the conditioning and sensing the something's wrong feeling. And I might say, well, call on the wisest place in you or call on your own awakened heart. And there's this incredible thing that happens in the midst of that, where the person might call on the Buddha or the Bodhisattva, but in moments, the voice that's coming out is really the voice of bodhicitta, the awakened heart mind, that it's always and already there. And that's what we forget. So this is really a path of waking up out of a trance and into this realization of that Buddha, that true nature that is our source. The main expression that we experience in the world when we wake up out of the something's wrong feeling is a huge amount of love that's free to be expressed. It's very hard to love in an uninhibited, unencumbered way when we think there's something wrong with me or there's something wrong with you. Very hard to love in that way. So what happens is when we begin to dissolve that, we really discover this kind of, what Chogyam Trungpo described, this fearless heart. He says, only by acknowledging our vulnerability and tender heart can we give birth to fearlessness. Real fearlessness is the product of tenderness. It comes from letting the world tickle your raw and beautiful heart. To open up without resistance or shyness and face the world as it is. Without anxiety about not perfection, opens us to this heart of fearlessness. The last peace dimension is really a kind of aliveness that comes. It takes a lot of our life energy to say something's wrong and act on that. A lot of our moments, a lot of our energy is wrapped around this whole sense of something's wrong. So what happens when we are no longer filtering that way? There's a huge amount of spontaneity. There's a lot of energy. There's a lot of freedom that's there. I sometimes watch children, and there's that question of where did our wildness go? And it went into trying to become a more perfect person and a better person. And you can see in children the spontaneity because they're not self-conscious. They're not operating so much usually. The messages come in pretty quick. But they're not, their life energy is not bound by that sense of something's wrong with me. So there's that kind of spontaneity. Some of you might remember the stories that Marie Sendak told that I think so wonderful. He was asked to share comments from readers, and he says, oh, there's so many. Can I give you just one I really like? It was from a little boy. He sent me a charming card with a little drawing. I loved it. Most of you know Maurice Sendak, a children's illustrator. I answer all my children's letters, sometimes very hastily, but this one I lingered over. I sent him a postcard, and I drew a picture of a wild thing on it. I wrote, Dear Jim, I loved your card. Then I got a letter back from his mother, and she said, Jim loved your card so much, he ate it. That was, to me, one of the highest compliments I've ever received. He didn't care that it was an original drawing or anything. He saw it, he loved it, he ate it. So that's the final gift I want to mention of when we wake up out of this, not that we go around eating birthday cards or whatever, but there's this freedom to appreciate and celebrate our lives. One writer, David Budbill, wrote a poem that was taken from a Chinese poet from 1,000 years ago who had said, the Chinese poet had said that we're just like bugs in a bowl. We're all day, we're just going around like bugs in a bowl. So here's the poem. I say, that's right. Up the sides and back down, round and around, over and over again. Sit in the bottom of the bowl, head in your hands, cry and moan. Or look around. See your fellow bugs. Say, hi, how you doing? Say, nice bowl. There is a very deep reflex, as I mentioned, it's conditioned, it's evolutionary, to scan for what's wrong. But the good news is it's not the end of our evolutionary story. And that is what draws us to a spiritual path, that it's part of our awakening to see that conditioning, especially the conditioning to turn on ourselves, to be caught in feeling flawed and bad, to see it, that wing of clear seeing, and to open our hearts in the moment to the experience in a very embodied way. And in those moments that we can see what's happening and open to it, we reconnect with the awareness and love that is our nature, and we start to trust that more and more. So that in time, and this is the unfolding and maturing of the path, in time, what happens is the conditioning still comes up, the ideas and feelings of bad personhood still come, but we don't believe it. There is more and more kind of a cellular, energetic trust in basic goodness. An energetic trust in loving presence as really being our nature. So I'd like to just invite you now, we'll do a final sitting together. And during these few moments, to just let the simplicity of these two wings of noticing what's happening and opening without any resistance. And you might begin just by listening. Just listening to the sounds. And without controlling or doing anything. Just receiving the sounds of these words, the sounds in the room, totally receptive. Sounds are known spontaneously. Just openness, receptivity, listening to the whole moment. Without any resistance. And with that same open receptivity, feeling the whole moment. Just from the inside out, just allowing this aliveness, the sensations of being. Without any resistance, completely present, open. Complete receptivity to the life of the heart, whatever the emotions are that are here. Completely allowing to notice and allow. Just to become that wakeful openness that this life moves through. These are the words of Rumi. He says, I must have been incredibly simple or drunk or insane to sneak into my own house and steal money, to climb over the fence and take my own vegetables, but no more. I've gotten free of that ignorant fist that was pinching and twisting my secret self. The universe and the light of the stars come through me. I am the crescent moon put up over the gate to the festival. We close with the prayer that our time together this evening, our reflections and meditations, might be of benefit to all beings, that all beings everywhere might touch the truth of loving presence, experience their nature as loving presence, that all beings everywhere might touch a natural and great peace. May there be peace on earth. May there be peace on earth. May there be peace everywhere. May all beings awaken and be free. Namaste.
The teaching you have received has been freely offered. If you would like to contact the Insight Meditation Community of Washington to make a donation or to learn more about our programs, please visit our website at www.imcw.org.